Welcome once again to Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. I'm Stephen Downs. We're in Module 5, Approaches to Ethics, and today's talk is going to focus on duty. Now, you might think that this is kind of an appropriate topic to pick, given that today is November 11th, 2021, or Remembrance Day here in Canada. And the topic of duty often comes up when we talk about our military obligations and our annual day of reflection on the service of people who have given their lives for our freedom and our democracy. I've chosen to go with a slightly different motif for the cover of this presentation, though, and I've picked police, and it looks like actually Australian police, but I couldn't say for sure. But I could have picked any number of professions, doctors, lawyers, even technologists, accountants, even researchers such as myself, perhaps academics and professors, all of us who feel informed in one way or another by a sense of duty. And so I didn't want to just go into the standard trope of, yeah, duty is a military thing and that's the beginning and the end of it. But I'm certainly not going to ignore that aspect of the concept of duty, and around it some of the associated concepts such as honor and courage and sacrifice. I think these are all interesting aspects of ethics and morality in general, and there's a whole history behind that, which I want to talk about today. So, the subject of duty is the idea, first and foremost, I suppose, of a requirement to moral action. And I'm kind of a free spirit, and I'll admit that right off the bat. And so, being required to perform a moral action is not the sort of thing that's ever appealed to me. But by the same token, that would certainly give other people grounds to say that, my being a free spirit is rather selfish and unethical way to live. So we can look at that from both sides. The branch of ethics concerned with duty is called deontic ethics. The word deontological comes from the Greek word deon, which means duty. And so basically, duty-based ethics teaches us that some acts are right and some acts are wrong, simply because those are the sorts of things that they are. Now, we usually think of ethics in terms of what the outcome is. If you do something and you kill a person, that something, whatever it was a morally bad act. Deontology doesn't work that way. And there's a few reasons for it, and I think these are actually pretty good reasons. One thing that deontologists will say is that we can never really know what the outcome of an action is going to be. Here we could be appealing to something like chaos theory or the butterfly thesis. So to the effect that we don't know down the line what's going to happen. We step on a butterfly, we change the weather in China. How could we know? Sometimes it also has to do with the idea that the outcome of the action is in a certain sense irrelevant, given our intentions to perform or not perform an action. If I shot at somebody, but he collapsed of a heart attack while the bullet was in flight, and the bullet ended up missing the person. There are no bad consequences. The guy's still dead, and he would have been dead anyways. But, you know, arguably my action was wrong because, you know, that's what I had in mind, was to kill the person. So, and it works the other way around, too. You know, you can intend to do good with your action, and sometimes bad things result. But the act was still morally good because it's that kind of action. It's a morally good action. Well, we could talk about that. The concept comes, well, I mean, the concept's probably been around since forever, right? You know, we can go all the way back to the Ten Commandments or the Law Codes or whatever you want. There have always been rules that are basically brought forward as guidelines or edicts of ethical behavior simply on the basis that these are the rules. And sometimes they're justified theologically. But more, they tend to be justified perhaps on the basis of human nature, but more just on the idea of what we might call natural law theory. And it's this idea that we can know about the laws of the world just by thinking about them. A triangle has an interior angle of 180 degrees. We know that. It's a law of triangles. And we know it just by thinking about it. 2 plus 2 equals 4. You know, we don't need empirical proof. We know about it just by thinking about it. And similarly, we can know moral truths in the same way. They're inherent in the concept of morality, if you want to put it that way. So, and some of these will seem really intuitively obvious to you. We have Aquinas, who was a proponent of this, and he says, for example, every substance seeks the preservation of its own being according to its nature. And by reason of this inclination, whatever is a means of preserving human life and of warding off its obstacles belongs to natural law. Living beings have a natural inclination to seek to continue living. And so an ethical law based on protecting our ability to keep on living seems to be a pretty obvious moral law. Life is good. And that's the foundation. And we can embed this in a system, and we can, you know, like the diagram shows, we can test our moral intuitions by creating predictions or creating moral principles out of them, applying them to specific cases and testing them against our intuitions. There's a whole process we can come up with here. But what it really boils down to is this idea that, you know, just the very fact that we are living beings and ethical beings gives us the moral intuition that life is good. Things that preserve life are good. There are different ways you can set this up. And one way is to distinguish between act intuitionism. That's the idea of knowing whether a particular act is a good act. Or rule intuitionism, where the focus isn't on the individual act, but rather on the rule that governs the act. And so the intuition is that this particular rule is a good rule. Following this rule is morally good. Don't lie is a rule. And so the intuition here is that following that rule would be good. Natural law persists. Natural law theory persists to today. It hasn't gone away. And I haven't done an empirical examination, but I would imagine that a good percentage of the population adheres to some form of it or another. John Finnis and Jermaine Grisetz are contemporary writers writing out of Notre Dame. And they've offered us a set of seven basic self-evident values from which moral norms could be derived. The seven are basically life, health, and safety, our capacity to know about reality and appreciate beauty, our capacity to be excellent in work and in play, our desire to live at peace with each other, neighborless friendship, our capacity to have aesthetic experience as a feeling of harmony and inner peace. And I can perfectly personally can speak to that one. Harmony between our choices, our judgments, and our performances. Walking the talk, if you will. And then finally, religion and the pursuit of ultimate questions of meaning and value, or perhaps of the cosmos and the nature of the universe. A lot of people are going to look at those principles and say, yeah, those are the kind of principles that I agree with. But, you know, one of the issues of natural law theory and this idea of moral intuitionism is a plurality of systems of morality. I mean, if you can just intuit it, who's to say that your intuition or my intuition or someone else's intuition is the right one and the wrong one? There are all kinds of ways of cashing this out in different kinds of intuitionist systems that may be more or less supported by the actual way humans are naturally. Now, there's a whole discussion, in fact, about what is natural for a person and what isn't. Is it natural for a human to fly? Well, clearly not. We can't flap our arms and become airborne, but on the other hand, we can build airplanes. What is natural on one hand seems to be what falls into the domain of what's possible. So anything a human can do with their body is natural. Or on the other hand, natural may have to do with overall purpose, objective, or goal, right? And if the purpose of a human is to stay alive and reproduce, then you can come up with a narrower definition of natural. Similarly, values, those values that correspond with our moral intuitions, can be described in any number of ways. I've illustrated just one such system here, Schwartz's value theory, which talks about four dimensions of values, including openness to change, self-transcendence, conservation, and self-enhancement, with subcategories of things like stimulation, hedonism, achievement, power, security. Now, are these good things? Are these bad things? Or is any combination of these things as values and non-values acceptable? Or I could bring in this context, Maslow's hierarchy. The five stages of needs that people have. And needs are certainly something that seem to flow from who and what we are. So we could begin, as Maslow does, with physiological needs, and then once those are met, look at safety needs, love and belonging, esteem, and then finally at the pinnacle, self-actualization. Or as one wag put in there as well, Wi-Fi. Gotta have Wi-Fi. So that's a weakness of, you know, the natural theory of ethics and value theory. So we can go back to what is the human, what is human nature, and a good place to start for this discussion in this context, in this day and age, is with Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French philosopher of the 1700s, who observed at the beginning of his book, Man is Born Free, but Everywhere He is in Chains. And the idea, let me just caricature it here, and rather than strive for precision, the idea is that the human naturally is good and virtuous. But society and the constraints and the artificial demands and artificial needs and desires that society brings to us constrain that. You know, and it's funny, you know, I express thoughts about Rousseau in this way, and I'm thinking as well as of Kylie Lawson of Adbusters magazine, or Noam Chomsky of Manufacturing Consent, talking about the same way the structures and actions of society create artificial desire, and in so doing impinge on one's dignity and one's freedom. And this is based on the system based on capital and self-interest. And here I'm quoting from the article, not from Rousseau himself, but from the article. The hope of creating a stable and just political society on the basis of narrow self-interest is a soul-shrinking and self-destructive dogma masquerading as a science of politics. For Rousseau, what was important was the meaning and importance of human dignity, the primacy of freedom and autonomy, and the intrinsic worth of human beings. And let me be careful here. When we use the word worth in this context, we're not talking about numerical worth, or, you know, thinking of it in terms of finances, how much money a human could get, or value, as in a person is more or less valuable. You know, we live right now in an environment where virtually every concept that we have in every discipline that we have ultimately it breaks down to some description in terms of money and finance. But Rousseau didn't live so much in that world, and he wasn't using the words like worth in that sense. And I don't think we should either. So, influenced by Rousseau and influenced by you know, the people like St. Thomas and rights theorists, we have Immanuel Kant, who lived in what is now called Kaliningrad. And never left the city. And Kaliningrad is on the far west side of the Baltic Sea, in what is now a Russian enclave, which is kind of interesting, but back then it was Prussia. So Kant talks about duty and the right of ethic as derived from reason out of the concept of necessity. So there are different ways we can get at this, but we'll get at it this way. Kant says, nothing in the world or outside the world can possibly be conceived that would be called good without qualification, except a good will. Now, by good will, he isn't meaning charity or goodwill stores or something like that, but more will in the sense of, well, maybe Nietzsche's will to power or Schopenhauer's will to live. You know, the actions of a rational being to project oneself, one's ideas, one's thoughts into the world. So he says goodwill is good because of how it wills. And how it wills is ethically. So a goodwill is good in itself. And he's also saying, and this is where he parts ways with the naturalist, morality should not depend on human nature. And should not be therefore subject to the fortune of change or the luck of empirical discovery. And here he's responding not only to people who think, well, something is natural, therefore it's good, but he's also speaking to people like David Hume and others who want to find what counts as good empirically by the evidence of the senses. But, you know, Kant looks at this and he says, this reduces morality to accident, to luck. You know, and just like the shirt on this slide is completely irrelevant to anything we're talking about, so also is human nature or empirical discovery. Because morality is something that we know through and by the pure exercise of reason and the will. Okay, so where does that take us? What Kant came up with is something called the categorical imperative. And even if you're not familiar with this phrase, you're certainly familiar with it in everyday life. It's like when you grab for the cookies on the table and try to take them all for yourself, and your mother says, what if everybody did that? And obviously, you know, everybody can't do that because there would never be any cookies. Same kind of thinking, right? So we can distinguish between a hypothetical imperative and a categorical imperative to give you kind of an idea of how this works. So a hypothetical imperative is something like, if you want something, then you must do something. If you want to be a doctor, then you have to go to school and get a medical degree. If you want to get to Regina, you have to go to Saskatchewan. Right? You see how that would make sense, right? And it's an imperative in the sense that if you want to do the one thing, then you have to do the other. And that was the structure of natural ethics. If something is a human, then it needs to live, for example, right? Well, Kant comes up with the second live, and Kant comes up with the categorical imperative, which basically simply drops the if part. So instead of saying, if you want A, then you must do B, the categorical imperative simply says, do B. And how do you arrive at that categorical imperative? Well, it's through a process of pure reason. And the pure reason that Kant offers is this. Act only according to the maxim by which you can, at the same time, will that it would become a universal law. So, think of a rule. I should take all the cookies for myself. Could you make that a universal law that governed everyone and everything? Well, no, you couldn't. So the maxim, I could take all the cookies for myself, is not a categorical imperative. It doesn't necessarily make it wrong. I mean, it might be, right? Taking all the cookies for yourself seems to be wrong, but not all of our actions are covered under the condition of becoming categorical imperatives. We do all kinds of things on a day-to-day basis. You know, I twiddle my pen, right? It doesn't matter whether everybody in the world does that or not. That's not the kind of thing that is mentioned. Nor even, you know, something like you should always twiddle your pen when you make a point about the categorical imperative. Yeah, sure, everybody could do it, but it wouldn't matter, right? So it's a bit deeper than that. The idea is that it's a maxim, it's a principle, it's a rule of conduct, where this rule of conduct is the imposition of an ethical will on the world. If everybody thought that this was an ethical thing, Could that happen? And according to Kant, and according to those who follow Kant, all of our specific duties, which may or may not include twiddling pens, can be derived from this one imperative. So, Kant actually expresses this in more than one way. And there are three major ways in which he says it. The first way is kind of an ontological way of saying it. Act only according to the maxim by which you can at the same time will, that it would become a universal law of nature. You see how he's flipped that around, right? Instead of nature imposing itself as a universal law of ethics on us, it's us coming up with this maxim and applying it to nature. And then we ask, could this be a law of nature? Could preserve one's life be a law of nature such that everything that lives tries to preserve one's life? Well, arguably it could, right? But there's another way. Act as to treat humanity, whether in your own person or in that of any other, in every case as an end and never merely as a means. And here we go back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the inherent worth, not as a monetary worth, but the inherent worth of every person. Here we think of every person as an end. Now, and we can cash that out in different ways as well, but I think a good way of thinking it is this. Every person is valuable in and of themselves as an end, in the sense that every person is able to have this will, this capacity of reason to create their own moral reality, their own understanding of ethics. And the idea is that they would all see, right? It's just like every person is valuable because every person can see mathematics in the same way. And then there's a third way of putting it. Act that your will can regard itself at the same time as making universal law through its maxims. Here we're not just talking about universal law of nature. Here we're saying universal law. And we can think law in the terms of, say, laws of God and man. Could the edict don't steal become the law of the land? Again, arguably it could. It wouldn't result in the collapse of society. And what we can see the appeal of this, I've sort of applied it to machine learning in the diagram on the left. I stole the diagram from an article in Towards Data Science, but it's the same sort of principle. So, take a human in action, human or machine action, run it through the deep learning network, and ask yourself, is the action within the ethical AI intuition scale? And we give as feedback, and here's where our own intuitions come in, yes it is or no it isn't. If no it isn't, then the action is prohibited, or if yes it is, then the action is allowed, the machine executes, or the human action is validated. And that feels a little odd, doesn't it? And I think that oddness is an intuition that we need to respect here. So, let's look at what Kant says. Act as though something could become a universal law. And let's ask it the other way around. What would prevent something from becoming a universal law? Because, as I said about, with respect to naturalism, anything the human body can do is natural. Which leaves pretty slim grounds for objecting to something on the basis that it's not natural. And a similar thing happens here. Pretty much anything that you can do is universalizable, even in some trivial senses, right? Like, all beings who are sitting in Stephen's office at this moment should twiddle their pen. Well, there's one and only one, that's me. It's universal law, we're done. And there's no contradiction in that. Well, maybe it should be more generalized. That becomes, what is it? Is it all people at this time who are any person twiddling any pen? It doesn't make sense. Logical contradiction is too weak a restriction here. Anything we could all do as humans falls under this. Anything and everything falls under this. Because nothing we do, nothing that anyone does in the world is a logical contradiction. By the simple fact that you can't do a logical contradiction. So that's why we get a different definition of preventing something from becoming a universal law. And we can invoke, say, the concept of the teleological contradiction, which is something like contrary to a purposeful and organized system of nature. And I mention that again with respect to natural law. Now I bring it up here with respect to contradiction. So we could say it's a contradiction to a purposeful and organized system of nature to act in a random and capricious fashion. Well, that seems to be pretty much the case by definition, right? And we could work from there. What would be random? What would be capricious? What would not lead to purpose? What would not lead to an organized system of nature, etc.? And so we could say, it's, a maxim like, love anyone you love, or love anyone you want to love, could raise a teleological contradiction because now love is no longer purposeful. It's not directed towards some end. It just is what it is. And people make that argument, and a lot of people oppose that argument. And it doesn't seem that that sort of contradiction is going to be sufficient on which to base moral law. Well, you could adapt it even to practical contradiction along the lines of it would be ineffective for achieving my purpose if everybody did it. So, and that's the cookie principle, right? If my purpose is to get as many cookies as I want, and my maxim is take all the cookies you want, then I am not going to get as many cookies as I want. I might not get any cookies at all. And so my maxim contradicts my practical purpose. And we see this actually in practice quite a bit, even during these days of the pandemic, which is why these images are here on the slide, where sure, people would like to not wear a mask, but what if nobody wore a mask? Well, then we would have a case of a widely spreading pandemic. And there's a whole ethos around that kind of thinking, and it extends far beyond ethics. We have this concept in economics, what we call the free rider. You've probably heard of that, right? And it plays out in things like the tragedy of the commons. And the idea here is that in a common environment where everybody is contributing, one person might decide not to contribute, but only to take. We'll call that person Donald Trump, just hypothetically. What if everybody behaved that way? Well, then nobody would produce anything. People would only be taking. Society would collapse. And so even the person who wants to take and take and take can't continue to keep on taking. And we come back to that quote about Rousseau's philosophy, basing a society on self-interest is, nonsensical. And it's nonsensical just particularly for this reason. If everybody acts only in their own self-interest, we don't get to have a society. Similarly, with the tragedy of the commons, if somebody goes into the commons, let's say the commons is an apple orchard, and they pick all the apples for themselves, and they take them away and they sell them on the open market, just like John Locke says they should, then nobody else gets any apples. And over time, the commons becomes overused. There's no apples even for seeds, and of course nobody's tending to the trees because this one person's taking all the apples, and the commons eventually collapses. And even the person who was taking the apples doesn't get any more apples. It's that the cookie jar kind of logic all over again. And that's the tragedy of the commons, and it results from failure to recognize the contradiction in that sort of selfish act, which in turn acts as justification for a division of the commons as private property among all the interested people, which ends up all in the hands of the person who took all the apples, but that's a different issue. Well, how does that line up with real life? Well, if you look at the actual practice of the actual professions, Sokol, for example, writing on ethics in the professional context, writes, "Religion, financial gain, reputation, personal character, social context, geographical location, severity, and the nature of disease, the climate of fear, these are all influential factors in doctors' decision to treat, perhaps more so than in any other period." So basically, it's an argument that says doctors, based on all these factors, can decide whether or not to treat a person. And the question we ask here in this context is this a universalizable principle? Would it work if all doctors were like that? Well, we've seen environments where all doctors are like that, where all of these things actually do play a role in whether a doctor treats a person or not, especially money, but also all the rest. People refusing to treat people because of religion, people unwilling to treat people because of the severity of the illness, etc. And the result is many people are left untreated. And so, arguably, this creates a practical contradiction. It's a weakness, a wound in society that continues to fester and fester and fester until you really can't fix it. And it's sort of like the doctor equivalent of choosing not to wear the mask. And at a certain point, just in order to be consistent, just in order for the whole profession of doctoring to make sense, you have to take away some of these, conditional and arbitrary and luck-based factors and go back to the principle, doctors treat everybody regardless. And that's where you get things like the Hippocratic Oath, and that's where you get things like organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, who, as I write, or as I speak, are treating people in Afghanistan and Syria and other places other doctors won't go. So there's something to be said there. Kant comes up with a number of examples. What if I make a false promise so I can get myself out of difficulty? Maybe a person's on a deathbed and they say, you know, honor my last wish. Give all my money to my kids. I don't care what my will says. And you say, yeah, I'll do that. Well, what if everybody did that? Then nobody's last wish would ever be respected. And nobody could trust that when they died, these wishes would be respected. And so people wouldn't leave anybody in charge of their wealth when they died. They'd do something else with it. Maybe just waste it. Maybe just burn it. Maybe just take it with them, like the tombs of ancient Egypt. Committing suicide. Again, what if everybody committed suicide? Well, the concept of a continuing society ends. You know, it's, and that's a principle that's actually been instantiated. We had Jim Jones, Jonestown, with the drinking of Kool-Aid, and that cult ended. We had David Koresh and the Branch Davidians, who went down in a wall of flame. It wasn't quite suicide, but it wasn't not suicide. Etc. There's any number of suicide cults. And one of the main results of suicide cults is the cult ends with the suicide. Neglecting one's talent. What if everybody said, I don't really need to develop my own talent? Well, then nobody would get anything done, would they? And so on. You get the, you can come up with more examples like this. And based on these examples and then generalizing over them, you can come up with something like a system of morality that we were able to think about as though it were the interior angles of a triangle. Just something that's based on logic and rationality, and that's it. Well, there are, of course, criticisms of Kant's approach, and I'll mention four of them here that have been brought up in various publications. Mandating trivial actions. I covered that earlier, and I don't really think that's an objection. Endorsing cheating. And I've actually illustrated that with a completely unrelated publication, but I thought it was pretty good because if we look at the factors that go into whether or not very well educated and very reasonable people actually decide cheating is okay. Social responsibility or mastery and approach of their goals isn't enough to get them not to cheat. You have to actually get them to agree to some kind of self-transcendence value, some idea that society is worth more than just whatever is good for me. But even so, you know, one would say, like, we can put this into a different context. You know, let's put it in the context of sports, and, you know, the similar sort of argument would be, well, for the good of the game, you shouldn't cheat. Because if you cheat, it just breaks down any trust in the game. And we think of baseball, and baseball almost ended when the members of the Chicago White Sox, who were then known as the Black Sox, were caught betting on games. Or caught, not betting on games, but throwing the game to assist people who were betting on games. But that doesn't eliminate cheating from baseball. We've had, in recent years, examples where the Houston Astros and the Boston Red Sox cheated. They used electronic devices in order to figure out what pitch a pitcher was going to throw, and then to signal that to the batter. It probably still happens even in the game today. And Major League Baseball is kind of meh. Yeah. Like, if you can do it and get away with it, fine. And you sort of wonder, you know, like, here we have a case where even for the good of the game doesn't give us an argument against cheating. And that seems like a pretty fundamental value to be indifferent about, certainly in the academic world. If cheating becomes a value, as it certainly seems to be in places like Harvard Business School, then somehow academic value is undermined. Other criticisms, prohibiting permissible actions. So the one example, the example I read is, I flushed the toilet at precisely 3:14 this afternoon. What if everybody did that? Well, especially in a small town where I live, but even in a large city, if everybody flushed the toilet at 3:14, the water pressure would drop to zero and it would have a bad impact on the water system. And we have the same sort of thing with these rules about the use of electricity during peak periods. But flushing the toilet at 3:14 is not wrong. Even though if everybody did it, it would be a problem. And so the permissibility of an act comes precisely because there's no reason to expect that everybody's going to do it. Even if you can hypothesize a scenario in which that happens. Then the worst of these is mandating genocide. And again, in the same article I read, it suggested, what if the principle was kill Americans? So what if everybody said, everybody lived by the maxim, kill Americans? Okay, well, this would be bad for Americans. But from the point of view of the rest of the world, this could actually be viewed as a good thing. Particularly if you're of the belief that Americans are overall a bad influence on society. Well, you might say, well, Americans aren't really a bad influence on society. But what if you really believed they were? Or pick your other ethnic group and say, well, suppose these are really a bad influence on society. The principle allows you to not only allow genocide, but to require it. And intuitively, that would be a bad consequence. And these are the sorts of things you have to think about when you're coming up with a principle like the categorical imperative, where you know, you're just using your mental process to come up with ethical rules. Particularly if you don't care about the results. Because at a certain point, you find yourself endorsing rules that are, sure, universalizable, but seem somehow to be wrong. And that's one of the major criticisms of an ethic of duty. That is basically inhumane. In Les Misérables, we could ask, was Jean Valjean wrong to steal bread to feed his starving sister's children? He got, I don't know what it was, 20, 24 years of hard labor for doing it, but was he wrong to do it? Would it have been wrong to lie to the Gestapo if you were hiding Jews from them? Well, if your moral principle is never lie, then, well, I guess you just have to tell them the Jews are there and take them out and have them executed. A lot of people wouldn't be comfortable with that, including myself. Not being comfortable is to understate that to a significant degree. And you know, actions like this really do, it seems, depend on the consequence and not just simply following a rule. But maybe we just don't have the right rules, right? Because there's also that principle about treating people as ants. And in pretty much all of these examples that we talked about, The bad result that we got really was a result of just treating people as disposable. The suicide thing, the cheating thing, the genocide thing, all of these are cases where we actually didn't take into account the dignity of human beings at all. So really, maybe it's a two-step process, right? So if we have a moral principle, the first question we should ask is, does it involve violating the dignity of a human being or human beings generally? And if it does not, then we ask whether the maxim can be universalized. So now we have a test, right? Should we lie to the Gestapo officer? Well, that doesn't really respect the dignity of the human beings who are hiding from the Gestapo officer. And so the answer would be, well, that's not a principle in this case. Lying to the Gestapo is not morally required, or morally objectionable, I should say. And that's a good thing. But now, now as our principle has become more complex, we have a question of, what does it actually tell us about how we should treat people? What does it really mean to violate or not violate the dignity of a human being? Well, there are different ways of expressing this. One way is another one of these universal principles that people cite on a constant basis, the Golden Rule. Golden Rule is basically the principle of treating others as you would like to be treated yourself. And as Wikipedia says, it's a maxim that's found in most religions and cultures. Lots of people repeat this mantra. It's a terrible rule. I'll say that right now. And I won't even be equivocal about it. First of all, how do you know how other people want to be treated? You could ask them, but they might lie, or you might misunderstand them, or they might not actually know themselves. So there are plenty of ways of getting that wrong. Just treat them how you would want to be treated yourself. But you are not them. And their tastes and your tastes might be very different. I see that in online forums all the time, where somebody comes into a forum, is rude, is direct, is littered with obscenities, attacks people personally, and you say something to him, and it's always a him, and he says, well, I don't mind if other people treat me like that. It's just, it's a dog-eat-dog world. And that doesn't seem like a good defense of that sort of conduct. It seems like a misapplication of the Golden Rule. And even more to the point, what about hypothetical situations? So, the Golden Rule is basically treat someone as you would want to be treated, right? You would want to be treated. This is what's called a counterfactual. And it's basically asking for your description of what would happen in a possible world. Not the real world, but in a possible world where that counterfactual is actually factual. And it's hard to get that right. It's hard to know what you would want in a particular situation unless you are in that situation. We see that all the time, where people say, well, I would not want to have them pull the plug at me if I was in that deathbed situation. And then you're in that deathbed situation, you realize, maybe I do. That kind of thing, right? Or I would not take the $1 million, even if I knew I could get away with it, from that company. And then you're in a position where there's $1 million on the table in front of you, all you have to do is pick it up, and a lot of people end up picking it up. So the golden rule isn't a good principle. It's a nice idea. It's an appeal to some kind of equity and a recognition, as I like to use, I used to like to say, other people are as deep as you think you are. It's a recognition of their humanity and their value in a non-monetary sense, but it's not a recognition of their uniqueness, their distinctiveness, and their autonomy, and that's a problem. There's another principle that's almost as widespread: from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And for today's times, we could have a gender-neutral version of it, or we can even extend that to include things like animals and robots. It's, of course, the core principle of socialism. It's kind of like a golden rule of economics, because it is a description of a society in which the dignity of each person is respected. A society that gives to each person according to their ability is very unfair and unthinking toward people who don't have very much ability, like babies, invalids, the elderly, people who are disabled, etc. But again, I need not say that there's been considerable objection to the socialist principle as well. So that comes back to, what does it mean to treat people with dignity? What does it mean to respect the individual value of each person? There's a more meta problem with the Kantian approach, and that's just the idea of defining the good itself as reason. If reason is what makes what we decide good, if this is it, then we have to ask, are those who have more reason than others intrinsically better? Now, one of the appeal of natural ethics is they're the sort of ethics that any common person can come up with just by thinking about it for a bit. So anybody, pretty much anybody, except, the aforementioned infants and invalids, can come up with principles like you shouldn't lie, you shouldn't kill, etc., as morally good principles. And just by their own innate capacity of reason. But what if you can't reason? And are thus not really a moral agent in that sense. Are we better than that person? Or, for that matter, are we better than animals because we can reason and they can't? Does somehow our conclusions have greater ethical purpose or ethical worth than theirs? Is our struggle for survival inherently ethically superior than, say, your dogs or your horses? Or flip that around. Suppose the super galactic came to us and were demonstrably better at logic and reason than we are. Because after all, it's not like logic and reason is one unified systemic whole. There's all kinds of ways of doing logic and reason. Whole other issue, but we can talk about that. And so it's easily imaginable that super galacticans could come and they've solved logic and reason, and they have one single unified system. Unfortunately, as in the Douglas Adams books, it means that Earth must be eliminated to make way for a bypass. Is that ethically right? Would we have to accept that? The principle that Kant brings forward seems to suggest that we should. But that would be the end of humanity, and that seems to me to be bad. But even more is just this idea of accepting reason as a value in and of itself, accepting reason as the locus of ethical good, that whatever is ethically good is so because we can arrive at it from reason. I've put a Ralph Steadman illustration in this slide to illustrate the opposite of that. And again, there's no good reason to put a Ralph Steadman slide in there, but I did. But even more to the point, Ralph Steadman is the gonzo to artists that Hunter S. Thompson is the gonzo to journalism. And the whole point of Hunter S. Thompson's journalism is that it's incredibly subjective and arguably insane, certainly drug-informed, and yet undeniably brilliant. And that's the problem with reason. It's not the only game in town. And it's not simply that the alternatives are just, you know, luck and chance. And the alternatives might produce the moral equivalent of a Ralph Steadman diagram. And, you know, from the point of view of reason, we look at that and it seems repugnant. But at a certain point, we say, well, wait a second, it's a Ralph Steadman. And there's a lot more going on there than we thought there was going on there. Another aspect to think about is autonomy. What's important in Kant's dictum is that we do not depend on an external moral authority to unveil moral law for us. We discover it for ourselves. I personally really like that principle. I mean, that's a big one for me because I don't like to be told, simply told, what's right and what's wrong. It goes back to the objection to duty that I raised at the beginning of this talk. But how autonomous are we really? And here I reference the Stanley Milgram experiment where people were basically convinced to apply greater and greater and greater electric shocks to victims. Now, spoiler, they didn't really administer electric shocks to victims, but they thought they were, and that's what counts here. And if it's that easy to convince people to administer electric shocks to people, then how trustworthy is the autonomy of individual moral agents? You know, I mean, we think that they're going to come up with good ethical principles just by reflecting on them, but, you know, if those reflections can be manipulated, they might come up with actually very bad moral principles. And there are plenty of examples through history where that has happened, where entire populations have been swayed to believe moral principles that objectively and with the hindsight of history, we now say were in fact very unethical. And that might even be happening now. And part of the problem is, how can you know? How can you tell? How can you be sure that the ethical principle you think you understand and apprehend intuitively has been actually fed to you slowly and carefully through an advertising campaign run by Bill Gates or the Koch brothers or pick your villain, right? And that's a problem. Now, we can manage for autonomy. We can develop social structures that preserve and promote real autonomy. I'm not sure if this diagram captures that. Does autonomy require trust? Does it require responsibility? You know, it's not clear that either of those is the case. And you know, part of the difficulty is coming up with a good account of just what we mean by autonomy. But certainly the lack of it would be fatal to, you know, any sort of theory of moral intuitions. Part of the problem with all of these theories is also being able to pick which theory applies. I talked earlier about the inhumanity of some of these moral principles, and we tried to address that by talking about viewing each person as inherently valuable. But even so, you know, if we've got, say, a list of seven principles like we saw earlier on, which one applies? You know, it turns out, you know, if you have a principle like do not lie, and if you have a principle like do not murder, or do not let somebody be killed, might be a better way of putting it, that can't be your morality, because those two principles can't both be true at the same time without some, shall we say, contradictory outcomes. And the Gestapo case is a perfect example of that, right? Let's say through some trick we thought that, no, I mean, overall, we're respecting people more by following the law and telling the truth than we are in lying in this case, right? So, but if we have a principle, don't let people die, and we have a principle, don't lie or don't break the law, and we're faced with this Gestapo situation, then we're stuck. And so W.D. Ross came up with a concept known as prima facie duties. And the idea here is that they're not strict laws in the sense of commandments or something like that. They are, you know, the expression prima facie means, you know, at first glance. So at first glance, it looks like it's a duty. You know, before considering anything else, yeah, this is a duty. But then in a plurality, with a plurality of principles, in any given situation one might be overridden by the other. And really, it depends on the situation right now as to which one of these principles ultimately will take hold. In the case of the Gestapo, don't let people die principle will be more important. But in another case, the don't lie principle might be more important. Or the self-improvement principle, or the fidelity principle, or even showing gratitude, or any of these others. Now, it still leaves us with the problem of being able to find, you know, these seven principles or whatever. And that difficulty, the issue of the genesis of these principles is a problem. It's easy to say, oh yeah, they just spring into mind intuitively, but it's hard when different principles spring into different minds. But if we accept the idea that any of these principles in any person are prima facie principles, but we can sit down as reasonable people and discuss and determine what the most reasonable outcome would be in the face of these conflicting principles, then we could continue with a deontic system of ethics and a system of ethics based in reason, while at the same time finessing the problem of the origin of principles and of the organization or the priority of principles. So we come back to professional duties, which is where we landed when we were talking about ethical codes. And we can look at these duties kind of in a different light. And if we look at the illustration on the right, we see that we have 15 duties to clients that CFP professionals must follow. The primary duty, of course, is fiduciary, because we live in a world of finances and economics. But then we have the professional obligations of integrity, competence, diligence, etc. Client interactions to disclose and manage conflicts. That's their version of the conflict of interest policy. To provide information, to represent compensation appropriately, etc., right? And we can think of these not as laws, but as prima facie duties. They describe the sorts of things that ought to be important to a professional, but in such a way that such a person in a profession is able to evaluate and weigh these principles and select the most important. And even the primary fiduciary duty might take second place to some other duties, like, say, comply with the law. And in fact, one of the issues that comes up with business ethics in general is that they interpret the fiduciary duty as being the only duty and actually overriding other duties such as complying with the law. And that is arguably a misunderstanding of business ethics. And thus, when somebody becomes a professional, or to bring us back to our subject, when somebody undertakes the practice of using AI and analytics in a learning context, we have these values, we have these principles. We don't need to justify them, we don't need to argue for them, because everybody knows what they are. We can sit down and reasonably think about them, and we don't even need a definitive list, because, you know, in any circumstance, a reasonable person can come up with, you know, here's a principle that applies in this case, right? We're collecting data. Principle that should apply here is consent. And we all know this, right? And here's another principle that applies in this case. Accuracy. Our data collection should be accurate. And now these two things are going to conflict with each other, right? If we get consent from people, that might impact the accuracy of the data. So what's more important? Well, it really depends on what we're collecting data for. And so the argument goes, right? And so that's how this kind of argument applies in the case of professional duties and in the case of the ethics of analytics and AI. The ethics really of any practical discipline-based system of ethics. And I think that's a good argument. The place where it's not a good argument, I think, is in the idea that we can rely on reason alone in order to come up with these determinations. Because as soon as you say things like, well, it depends on the context, it depends on how important the research that we're doing is, etc., now we're appealing to something, some body of facts outside our particular discipline. And that's where the problem comes in, right? Kant would say, well, now you're just depending on accidental circumstances. If you're right in this case, it was just purely by luck, right? And you're making morality conditional and contextual. It's relativism. There is no morality in such a case, he might say. And certainly I've seen that expressed. But what's the resolution here? I mean, there isn't a way to simply use reason in order to weight these prima facie duties. I mean, as soon as you start saying prima facie duties, the reason part gets you to the first glance, but then you have to check your math, and that involves looking at actual P's and actual people. And that kind of gets at probably what is an overall problem with duty-based and rule-based systems generally. And it's that morality seems to be about more than that. A morality is more than simply following the rules, even if they're really good rules. Hearst House says, if right action were determined by rules that any clever adolescent could apply correctly, how could this be so? Why aren't there moral whiz kids the way there are mathematical and quasi-mathematical whiz kids? Why don't we see evidence of these super reasonable, super moral people that, we can just see our moral authorities? If anything, we're when such a person shows up and claims to be such a person, we think of them more as cult leaders than anything else. But more to the point, just simply following rules, following the dictates of reason, seems to go against our moral intuition. Our moral intuition goes against our moral intuition. This is really effectively brought out through the narratives of Star Trek. Spock is this purely reasonable person. And yet Spock, even though his determinations of the ethics of a situation according to various principles, and some of them are articulated through the course of Star Trek, like infinite diversity and infinite combinations is one of them, and there are others. And even though Spock's reason comes from a really good place, as a way to put behind the violence of the original Vulcan race, it nonetheless seems to ring hollow to people, as just not capturing or grasping the humanity of ethics. And we see the same kind of scenario play out in Star Trek The Next Generation, except instead of Spock, we've got a robot, Data, who again is ruled by algorithm and principle, and again, we have people suggesting, does not respect the humanity of the situation, despite Data's own efforts over time to become more human, to find, as he says, the human equation. And I think there's actually an argument offered by the writers of Star Trek in this situation to try to convince us that, no, the robot actually could pull it off. Although he might need an emotion chip. I think that, the arguments are well made. And it's not the case that, no robot could ever be ethical. It's not the case that no AI could ever be ethical. I don't think that's what follows from this. But I think that what does follow from this is that no system of ethics based simply on reason, duty, and principles could ever be ethical. Just because, like the ethics slide in this diagram, it feels too much just like plugging text into a template and hoping that ethics pops out the other side. But as Field and others write, the concept of ethical principles for AI has encountered pushback, both from ethicists, some of whom object to the imprecise usage of the term in this context, as well as from some human rights practitioners who resist the recasting of fundamental human rights in this language. And it does go back to, how do we respect human dignity? How do we respect the worth and value of each person? I happen to believe that that's a good principle, that each individual human, each individual life, for that matter, and by that I even include trees, has inherent value and worth. Not in the financial sense, because that's a stupid way to measure the value of life, but just in the sense that it has a right to exist. It determines its own value and it's not the sort of thing really that we should be using or commoditizing to our own purposes. But you can't capture that with the rule or any number of rules. It's not the sort of thing that you can just pull out of the air with an algorithm. It's going to require something more. And I think that in a lot of the debates about the ethics of artificial intelligence, one of the key shortfalls of many of these discussions is that coming from a certain technically oriented, machine-oriented perspective, the proponents don't necessarily grasp that the ethics need this thing that is more. And again, that's why in the ethical codes I went well beyond just the ethics of artificial intelligence and analytics and went into other professions like accounting and healthcare and teaching and journalism and the like. Because in these professions, the need for that something more, whatever it is that much more evident than it perhaps ever would be when you're working with and building purely artificial systems. So that's what I've got to say on this, on duty. I think it's a really interesting way of approaching ethics. I think it says a lot of good things, but I think that the discussion of ethics does not begin or end with the principle of duty. I'm Stephen Downes. Thank you for joining me, and I'll talk to you again next time.